wildfires, but they're significantly less of a risk than many other countries, like Turkey, for instance.
We'll be right back with more from Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol, speaking about the health cost of repeated climate stressors.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We're back with Dr. Dan Mitchell talking about your health and climate change. Well, speaking of extreme heat, though, you also co-authored a study finding scorching heat over 50 degrees C is rapidly increasing in parts of the Mediterranean and the Middle East due to human influence. That was published a year before Greece hit 44 degrees C in June 2024. The Acropolis had to close and tourists, including British tourists, died in the heat, like the British TV presenter Michael Mosley. Several places in the Middle East did hit 50 degrees Celsius, that's 122 Fahrenheit, during the 2024 summer. So what are your expectations having done that previous study?
Yeah, well, it's exactly as you say, you know, 50 degrees, there's nothing special that happens at 50 degrees Celsius, but it is economically a very important number. So a lot of countries actually have 50 degrees as a threshold where they'll stop outdoor workers, they'll still pay them, for instance, so it's an economic thing, and a lot of alert systems go into place. So it's a very important number structurally for many countries, especially countries, say, in the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, those sort of countries where you can get those sort of temperatures. So it was important to show that rise and the fact that countries in southern Europe would start to see some of these things. As you rightfully said, during particularly hot extreme, then Michael Mosley unfortunately passed away due to heat stress. Now, he was an incredibly well-informed doctor. He knew this stuff as much as anyone, and yet he still, you know, heat stress still got him, and that really goes to show that these things are lethal, and you have to take them very seriously, even though you can be very well informed. His situation was a bit different because, he got lost on a trail. But still, we often say things like carrying extra water and things like that can really help save lives here.
And scientists on this program and everywhere are saying extreme events will be worse and will come more often due to greenhouse changes. And another worry we have here is that it could affect babies in the womb. It's dangerous for pregnant women. And then, of course, the babies may be affected for life afterwards. Did you talk about that in your short article in Nature?
Yeah, so the effect of weather and weather-related stress on pregnancy is becoming a much larger area of research. You know, in a sense, every one of the mothers listening to your program will know that it's incredibly stressful when you're pregnant. And in normal stress situations, then you can feel it even more so. So there's a clear logical reason to think that if you're pregnant and a huge heat wave is going off, things are going to get bad. There have been some direct studies, though, that which have followed the child once it's been born through actually decades of its life after very stressful in utero weather event conditions. Some has been the Canadian outage, the storms in 1998 in Quebec. There's a cohort of children that have been followed from that event. And so that was a month of power outages during a very large snowstorm, for instance, in Quebec. And they saw that later down the line, 20 years down the line, these children had higher mental health problems compared to other children born at that time, including things like anxiety and depression and PTSD.
They say people can die of a broken heart, and do we know whether just stressing about storms or heat waves actually leads to poor health? Dan, does news of disasters possibly damage us, even if we don't go through them personally?
disasters can make people upset. That's true. I think that the bigger problem is probably this idea of climate anxiety. So that's the idea that climate change as a whole is going to bring particularly problematic weather conditions. In some cases, people talk about not having a future, or the Earth as we know it's going to be very different. And I think there's a communication problem there. Very few real scientists are saying that climate change is going to end the world, or it's just not a livable future for most of us. What we're saying is things are getting worse. We're saying that everyone's health will be impacted in a way, and maybe you have to take more precautions. Maybe you need to spend more of your money on adaptation. Maybe you need to be more wary of communities which don't have a lot of money, especially in the developing world. And I think some people have taken this idea a bit too far, and they kind of feel like they can't have a family because the world's going to be too bad in the future. That's absolutely not what the science is saying. The science is saying that overwhelmingly, a world population, we will be worse off, and it's something we should try and avoid as much as possible. But it's definitely not the end of things. It's just making life more difficult. And I think we need to communicate those points more clearly. There's no doubt that acting now, stopping climate change, will save lives, and it will save a hell of a lot of money. But yeah, there's a nuance there that should be made quite clear. And I think especially some of our younger climate change supporters may be thinking that we're saying something a bit more world-ending than we actually are in this case.
Well, humans have a tendency for that. People have been talking about that since the Middle Ages and before, that the end of the world is coming and they expect it. Now, I would like to add a note for our listeners. It's news about another study finding climate change is linked to worsening brain diseases. In June, a big team of medical professionals published a study on climate change and disorders of the nervous system. It was in The Lancet Neurology. They say, quote, evidence suggests that the incidence, prevalence, and severity of many nervous system conditions, for example, stroke, neurological infections, and some mental health disorders, can be affected by climate change, end quote. So we can add brain damage and mental health problems, possibly, to climate change. Does that fit in with what you know, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you really step back and think about this problem, we as humans have evolved to the weather on our planet. That's how evolution works. Climate change is changing that weather at a very rapid rate. So just from a basic logical standpoint, we're so ingrained with the weather and everything that we do that if we change that in a quick way, it becomes very clear as to how this might affect every aspect of our health. And our job as scientists is really to try and quantify that, try and come up with solutions which mitigate against that.
And the new concept in your Nature article, and this probably applies to a lot of living things, so well beyond humans, it's repeated trauma from ongoing climate disasters may add up to significant tolls on our health. That sounds important for medical practitioners, but also governments trying to plan responses. Dan, why don't we know more about this?
There are a couple of different pathways. The first is when you start thinking about things in the longer term, our models become infinitely more complex. And you could see that if you took a single person, if they were exposed to a flash flood, which typically occurs over a couple of hours, you could very clearly say what's happened to that person during that flood. However, if you took that same person and said, well, let's trace their life over the next 30 or 40 years and see how climate has changed their life, you would have to know exactly where they've been, which countries they've lived in, have they spent more time indoors or outdoors. All of these other sort of causal factors come into play, and it becomes much more difficult to say, yes, the increase in temperature alone was what caused these problems in this person. It could be the fact that that person is getting older, and in older people, they see those problems. it could be that at some point in their life they develop some sort of infection which makes them much more susceptible to certain things. It could be that they started off in a very rich family but went into poverty. All of these other socioeconomic factors, these geographical factors, are really hard to disentangle over the longer term. But on the shorter term, for say the flash flood or the short heat wave, then you know all of these at that instant. And that's one of the real problems with this longer term burden.
From your time as a research scientist at Oxford, you worked on a range of climate issues, such as the polar vortex, for example. What steered you toward investigating the health impacts of climate change?
Well, the health impacts are some of the most direct things we can see for climate change. There's also so much to be done on the methods to really understand these pathways. You mentioned the paper about brain damage in The Lancet. You know, that's a very significant finding that was not particularly well known before. And it's such a rapidly moving field that we're always finding these sort of connections that perhaps we didn't even think about beforehand. And so it makes it a very important field to be in at the moment. It's also the one area where we really feel we can go to our governments around the world and we can point at data and we can say, look, here's the amount of people dying because of inaction of climate change. Here's what you can do to help prevent them die. And by the way, you should be cutting carbon emissions as well, because otherwise you're just putting a plaster over the problem. Clearly, that doesn't work with every government. I'm not going to mention names, but I'm sure your viewers can guess who I'm talking about. One of the real issues is governments often come in cycles, often 4 or 5 year cycles, and what one government might want to do or invest in is not necessarily what another one might be, and that really slows the progress towards net zero.
Well, as we wrap this up, is there anything else you would like listeners to know about climate change and their health?
The only thing I would say is there's a lot you can do personally for your own health. And, you know, heat waves is one of the biggest killers globally. There's quite a bit people can do just to prevent these sorts of things. In that case, it might be checking up on elderly relatives. It might be drinking more water. It might be changing the way you open or close windows or curtains in your house, for instance. So for a lot of these problems, there are pretty logical and simple solutions. That's absolutely not always the case, especially for populations in poorer parts of the world. But my point to your viewers are there's a lot you can do yourselves to make your families and your close friends resilient to these sort of extreme events. It's not all about governments or other organizations doing it.
From the University of Bristol, we've been speaking with Professor Dan Mitchell. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dan, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
A stun grenade, also called a flashbang, suddenly overloads our senses. We cannot react. Isn't that how it is right now? That is the state of human affairs and the natural world. Load up a continuing pandemic, unbearable heat, city burning wildfires, big storms, vandals in government, fearful markets, worried people. We are stunned. And the name for that is polycrisis. It is not temporary. It is a byproduct of superindustrializing in overdrive. As Adam Tooze, the British historian and professor at Columbia University, explains, a polycrisis doesn't just happen. It is made.
Economics, politics, geopolitics, and then the natural environment blowing back at us. That's why I think the polycrisis term has a real utility. And then it was picked up by Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, in 2015-2016 to describe the experience of trying to govern Europe when you had to deal with the Greek debt crisis, Putin's first aggression against Ukraine, and the sort of rumblings of Brexit in the background, and the refugee crisis in Syria spilling over into Europe. And I think what he was trying to get at, and why I think the term is still useful, is this experience of not a single crisis with a single clearly defined logic, the financial crisis, and it's about mortgage-backed securities and they're blowing up, but this coming together at a single moment of things which, on the face of it, and really when you even dig into it, don't have anything to do with each other, but nevertheless seem to pile on to each other to create a situation in the minds of policymakers, business people, families, individuals, when we're thinking about the COVID crisis, for instance, that is overwhelming and that leaves us unable to cope and, you know, questioning our identity and finding it very difficult to decide what the ground is that we stand on, because it's being destabilized from so many different directions at once. And there are different versions of, I think, this experience, especially if you live in North America, if you live in the United States. Americans have been experienced, certainly liberal Americans, I think conservatives feel it too, a kind of sense of national crisis that's quite comprehensive, but they read it as the experience of the American dream coming apart. Whereas I think the polycrisis concept captures this as a much more general experience. And I think in the last, I wouldn't confine it to the last couple of years. Juncker said it started in 1516. I think you could make a good case that really the unfolding of this current moment starts in 2008, which is simultaneously not just the financial crisis, which we all remember, but also Putin's first aggression against Georgia. It is also the breakdown of the WTO in the Doha round. It is setting the stage for the disappointment of the Copenhagen climate talks. And then on top of everything else, there was a swine flu epidemic in 2008-09. And so in a sense, you already see there many of the elements of the current moment coming together. And the key things for me are finance, politics, if you like, the disruptions of American democratic politics with Sarah Palin being put on the GOP ticket in 08. So economics, politics, geopolitics, and then the natural environment blowing back at us. And those four things, they don't reduce to a single common denominator, right? They don't reduce to a single factor. And that's why I think the polycrisis term has a real utility, descriptively as much as anything else, because it's kind of hand-waving. Of course, it's kind of arm-waving. It's going, look, there's a lot of stuff happening here all at once. And that precisely is what we're trying to get our wrap our minds around. And as the Club of Rome report and various types of epidemiological expertise were saying at the time, the dawning awareness that the miracle of economic growth, which had been, you know, really taken off in a dramatic scale after World War II, has a downside. So that a series of really very dramatic risks are not just merely exogenous anymore, but are being generated by the very success of our economic growth story. And that awareness really comes quite sharply into focus, both on the, shall we say, resource environmental envelope side, but also on the pandemic disease zoonotic mutation side in the 1970s. And so that, for me, would be the moment where the modern polycrisis mode becomes visible, this first beginning to be articulated. And if you take Edgar Morin, so the French theorist who first coined the term, if you take his intellectual biography back, he's a classic 1970s environmental alarmist.
Wait a minute. Speaking to the wealthy movers and shakers at Davos, Adam Tooze claims the inventor of the polycrisis concept was a classic 1970s alarmist. Actually, it's too bad we did not listen enough to the French theorist of complexity, Edgar Morin. At the time of this broadcast, Edgar is still alive at the age of 103 in Paris. He is the author of over 60 books, not many of them in English. A polymath who contributed to everything from media studies to ecology and systems biology. Morin is recognized as a pioneer in complexity and complex thought. He is a founder of transdisciplinary work. Bring me many more such alarmists, please. For me, Adam Tooze is not suggesting a carefully planned conspiracy to create this pack of converging threats. While there may be actors who temporarily capitalize on these civilizational threats, the total package is produced by all of us in a system which is destabilizing due to unplanned and somewhat unforeseen consequences. The cabal at the top struggles in the whirlwind just as we do, blown even harder, perhaps, than the peasants below. We've covered the polycrisis extensively on Radio EcoShock. I recommend our program, Coping in the Polycrisis, broadcast in March 2023. I had systems and security expert Homer Dixon on here. Listen to that program right from my website at ecoshock.org or download it free to your own device and listen later.
With the work of the Columbia University historian Adam Tooze, the concept's been getting a lot of airtime in his blogs and Substack blogs, and also a lot of conversation at the World Economic Forum, as just kind of a general label for the fact that the world seems to be incredibly chaotic, and we're being, as you suggested, hit by one shock after another. A lot of them related, of course, to climate change, but then we had the pandemic and the financial and economic consequences of the pandemic, food crisis that was aggravated by the pandemic and also by the Ukraine-Russia war and the war itself, of course. And it seems like all of this stuff is happening. I think a lot of the commentators, including those at the World Economic Forum, think of this as just in a sense, bad luck. You know, just a lot of stuff happens to be going wrong simultaneously, and we'll weather it, we'll move beyond it, and life will get back to something like normal. We're arguing in our work that actually the coincidence of crises is not a coincidence. In other words, there are underlying mechanisms that are driving the synchronization of a lot of these crises that we don't fully understand. So we haven't unpacked the causal dynamics entirely, but it's not just chance that a whole bunch of things are going wrong simultaneously.
Homer Dixon is director and founder of the Cascade Institute in British Columbia, and he operates the helpful website at polycrisis.org. But is the convenient catch-all label of polycrisis, beloved at Davos, COP27, and all the elite functions, is it really a distraction from the fundamental ecological mega-crisis? Doesn't it make climate change or species extinction just one of many concurrent problems like migration or inflation or many human-only issues? In his 2023 discussion at the World Economic Forum at Davos, Adam Tooze says he is a Keynesian, using economic theory developed by John Maynard Keynes. Keynes is the architect of democratic economies, including ways to survive the Great Depression of the 1930s. He advocates government intervention. Bailouts and Green New Deals ever since draw on Keynes' work. Here, Tooze describes the Keynesian technique of breaking down the polycrisis into a series of subthoughts called a black box.
And what's so interesting about Keynes is he has a politics of black boxing. So he's generally speaking a Democrat in favor of trying to maintain democracy and its functioning in a very fragile moment in the 20s and 30s. But to do that, what he thinks is that you need to take certain problems off the agenda. So the problem of unemployment or the problem of excessively high interest rates and uncompetitiveness can be addressed by economic policy. So what he's trying to offer is a set of technical fixes that allow you to take those issues off the board so that then you can concentrate the limited scope there is, the limited political capital is, the building consensus or just functioning democracy on issues which are harder to resolve and where genuine political agreement is needed. And that seems to me to be a model for thinking about our current moment.
Can we really pull out connected pieces to apply a technical fix? Can we take COVID or climate change off the table for now to focus on other things? Doesn't that make them both more dangerous? Anyway, all the parts of the polycrisis interact and then morph into other states. I worry some Greens tend to put the environment in a black box, leaving out things like inequality or wealth or racial injustice, because those aren't our issues. We just want to concentrate to solve global warming to get clean air and clean water. But can that ever happen in a dictatorship or a fascist corporate state? Beware of black boxes, that's all I'm saying. Tooze may take comfort in psychoanalysis and promote his liberal Keynesian economics, but I think that's a little too late, too late. He offers a comforting formula as though we can control ourselves or our fate now that this grand experiment with the atmosphere has been launched on Earth. Keynesian thinking and even the Green New Deal may be archaic thought systems from the time before the Anthropocene and the Great Acceleration, before artificial intelligence and global communication, before human systems began their flight into the sun with wings attached of wax. Call us doomers or realists, natural systems and our own madness will most likely force massive degrowth and depopulation on us one way or another, sooner or later. Nothing can grow forever on a finite planet. This horrible but required reset may be already underway. Real choices, such as they are, assuming we survive as a species with some knowledge, will be made after, and likely not by most of us, sharing these thoughts today. So that is where post-doom thought and belief begin.
Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation. You know print media is floundering. TV has totally sold out to the big corporate machine and they're losing viewers. Nonprofit radio is one of the last stands of advertising free speech. I count on you to put your money where your ears are by supporting your nonprofit radio station.
We started this program with radical uncertainty. Imagine landing a large passenger plane in a dense fog. You have instruments and radar, all provided by science, as our guide. We need to land this crazy heat engine, despite the fog of uncertainty and unknowable consequences. Destabilized life requires radical action to decelerate, to reach terra firma safely again. In coming shows, we explore a plausible driver of current human failure, brain rot. We always presume humans are getting more intelligent. The news suggests otherwise. Are we getting stupider? Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. This is a climate emergency. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
We are the arsonists. We did light the fire. When the fires come foam and smoke rolls in, it seems like God or some chaotic power. Of the flames in the climate. Ain't seen rain since I don't know when. Nobody knows if we see it again. Dark love just waiting to light it up. We run on fumes to the grocery store. Burn that tar from the down. Seen rain since I don't know when. Nobody knows if we see it again. Dark luck just waiting to light it up. We run on fumes to the grocery store. Burn that tar from the down below. Oily smoke in the air, you know. But remember,
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.